You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Attacks in Afghanistan by insurgent Taliban forces have become more frequent recently, and many observers are concerned that the country is increasingly unstable and may even be starting to resemble Iraq. So we thought we would check in again with Sarah Chase for today's underreported segment. She joins me now live from Kandahar. Ms. Chase, a former NPR correspondent, now lives in Kandahar, where she has started a cooperative business called Arghand. She's also written a book scheduled for release from Penguin later this summer. It's called The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. And Sarah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome back to the show.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, we've asked you to talk today as part of our underreported feature. In the light of regular news coverage of the escalating violence, do you think it's fair to call the situation in Afghanistan underreported nonetheless?
It's become a slightly less underreported in the last, I would say, month or two, partly as Canadian troops have come down here to Kandahar to replace a certain number of Americans. There's been a flood of Canadian journalists. And then, as usual, with gunfire come reporters. So I would say in the last month or two, it's been slightly less underreported than usual.
Although the article in today's New York Times was on page 6. And that's despite all of the violence recently, Condoleezza Rice's visit. Earlier this week, Germany's defense minister said that he's worried that Afghanistan will become Iraqified. Is that something that people are talking about in Afghanistan?
You know, conflict and post-conflict societies are extraordinary navel gazers. So Afghans don't really compare their situation to Iraq much at all. They don't have much time to think about Iraq, frankly. But I have certainly described the situation to friends, but not just recently, going back a year or so to, you know, I would say it's sort of like Iraq on a slow boil.
Well, yes.
Similar developments, but taking place at a much slower pace.
Although it seems to have escalated recently.
It has. It's escalated quite dramatically recently, but I would really like to emphasize that this didn't come out of nowhere. What we've been seeing in the last 6 months has been really the logical conclusion of a progression that I've been watching since about 6 months after the Taliban left. As I said, it's like a time relief version of Iraq. And the other thing that's a little bit deceptive about it is that it hasn't been a steady progression. It's been a kind of sawtooth progression. There will be these spikes in violence and then a lull for several months, and then the next spike goes even higher. And so you find very quickly that you're inured to levels of violence that horrified you, you know, 4 months or 6 months earlier.
You're located in the south, which is usually referred to as the Taliban stronghold. Is its presence apparent to you?
Sorry, is what presence?
The presence of the Taliban, not only was Kandahar its center, but the south itself is obviously where the Taliban is fighting from.
You know, it's very interesting, though. It's true that this has been the stronghold, this southern Afghan region has been the stronghold of the Taliban movement. But I wouldn't describe what we're experiencing as an indigenous uprising by ideological foes of the current regime in Afghanistan or the Western presence here. Although most of the foot soldiers are indeed from the Afghan south, and although they're able to find, you know, places to sleep at night and food from villages down here, this is really it's more like a low-grade invasion, I would say, being directed from across the border in Pakistan. And so what you often find, for example, in the villages just about 10 minutes outside of Kandahar now, where there's been heavy, heavy fighting, where we, in fact, Arghand has rose plantations, so, you know, we have a certain amount of information on what's going on, most of the people who are camping out in those, most of the Taliban who are camping out in those villages are not from those villages. They're from other provinces, either Helmand in the west or Zabul to the north of here. And then I picked up a young boy hitchhiking in Zabul province on the way to Kabul, and he said his village was full of Taliban, but none of them were from his village. So it's not really, I mean, in that regard, it's not really an insurgency the way Iraq is. It's not a spontaneous local uprising. Now, I could hear you, you know, maybe wanting to ask, well, then what, you know, why are villages providing comfort, succor, food to these people? And it's a complicated answer. Partly it's sheer intimidation. There is so little functioning police activity, you know, on the part of the government here that villagers are totally on their own. So when you've got 20 armed guys who show up at your doorway and say, you know, do you have some extra dry bread? It's kind of hard to turn them down. But beyond that, I would say that there is also a degree of disillusionment with the government, the Afghan government, and its international backers. And again, I really want to stress that it's a practical disillusionment. It's not ideological, anti-Western, anti-Christian, or anything like that. It's that this government is corrupt. It's that, you know, I took a guy who had gotten hit by a car to the hospital, and the, you know, it's a public hospital, a government hospital. The doctor is literally chatting on the telephone while he's, you know, kind of vaguely positioning an x-ray plate. You can't get a single piece of paperwork accomplished without having to pay bribes. Soldiers here treat people with the kind of brutality they otherwise reserve for dogs. And that has created a level of disillusionment that makes maybe giving some space to Taliban fighters feel like a protest vote in a way. Because there's not a properly functioning political system either here, so it's not like you can vote for the other party or something like that. And so it is a complex picture on the ground.
And who's responsible for this environment of corruption? Could Hamid Karzai have changed things? Is it the result of the way that the invasion worked and power was apportioned?
Both. Yes to both halves of that question. One is that it is true that after the fall of the, after 9/11, the United States kind of took shortcuts in the proxies that it chose to kind of whip up against the Taliban and then empower after the Taliban fell. But it's also true, I think, that President Karzai, while I don't believe that he himself is corrupt, has just presided over an absolute free-for-all. And at some point, you know, I think that if there is tyranny and corruption in your house and you don't do anything about it, then you yourself become a tyrant. And I just think that he's not at all taking advantage of the mandate that he enjoyed from the Afghan people to clear these thugs and predatory, you know, creatures out of his government. He just really hasn't made the effort that he could have. And so that helps explain the rising disillusionment with President Karzai himself, which was kind of in evidence in Kabul a month or so ago when, as a result of a traffic accident, the whole city went up in flames. It was really clear that some built-up frustration was being vented.
Well, he got a mandate from the whole world, not just from the Afghan people. I remember after he came to office 4 years ago, Gucci designer Tom Ford called him the most chic man on earth. But hasn't he tried at least to rid the administration of corruption on some level? He recently appointed 13 new police chiefs, all of whom, unfortunately, some people say had links to crime or human rights abuses.
The police chief who was appointed down here in Kandahar had been removed from his position as head of counter-narcotics by the previous interior minister because he was believed by internationals to be kind of throwing away some of the narcotics he was supposed to be fighting. That's one. The police chief of Kabul is a well-known local bandit. I mean, notorious local bandit. And this is the kind of thing that makes people just pull their hair out. There are competent and honest people in Afghanistan, and they're not getting appointed. And it's as though President Karzai feels that he can buy off his enemies with positions, and he keeps shuffling these thugs from one position to another.
And he's now being called the mayor of Kabul because it's kind of like a fortress mentality these days, although he claims he's been traveling around the country. How safe is Kabul? During Condoleezza Rice's visit, officials at the American Embassy were prohibited from leaving the sandbag premises. They were told that they couldn't stroll through the marketplaces and bazaars or mingle with local people. And she was only in Afghanistan for 5 hours.
Yeah, U.S. officials never do that. Embassy officials don't stroll through the market. Kabul, I was there about a month ago, and I was pretty stunned by how fortress-like the place looks. I mean, there are tank traps and sandbags, you know, through whole swaths of town. Now, you know, I live a slightly different way from most internationals, and even down here in Kandahar, I drive through the bazaar. I don't walk too often in the bazaar, and I usually would have somebody with me if I'm walking around. I've started taking levels of precaution that I hadn't in the past year or so. I have taken again to wearing Afghan men's clothes when I am outside in the street, particularly if I'm driving, just to make myself look less conspicuous. But Kabul, and I also think the recent riots in Kabul really shook people. The other thing to remember is this whole country is like, it's a society suffering from collective post-traumatic stress disorder, you know? And so when incidents that may not appear as grisly as what goes on in Iraq, for example, when these incidents occur, it really triggers the kind of stored-up trauma that's inside people. A friend of mine worked in a ministry in Kabul, and she said there were men and women weeping in the corridors of the ministry during these riots because they were hearing gunfire again in Kabul. They were hearing shells, you know, rocket-launched grenades going off and things like that. And women who work with me here in Aragon, they saw the injured from a car bomb recently, who were being rushed to the hospital, and they came here practically in tears. Again, not because any of these people were relatives of theirs, but just because psychologically, you just can't take much more of this, you know?
Sarah, as a businesswoman, do you have to pay bribes to get things done?
I refuse to do that, which I can get away with because I'm a foreigner. Recently, we had to deposit some money in the National Bank in order to be registered as a cooperative. And, you know, a first effort to extort a bribe of $10, we thwarted, and then the disgruntled bank employee said, okay, well, for each of the, you know, papers that I'm signing for you, I need 20 Afghanis each, which the total would have been five, the total would have been $2. I take 100 Afghanis out of my pocket. I said, glad to give it to you. Just sign me a receipt for it. You know, this isn't my money. I need to account to my, you know, to my cooperative. And he said, I can't give you a receipt. I said, well, then I can't give you the money. And he says, okay, we're not going to finish your work. You have to come back tomorrow. I don't know how I did this, but suddenly I landed on top of his desk, sitting cross-legged in his papers. And I said, okay. I'm not moving until you finish our work. And, of course, it finished in about 5 minutes. This, you know, I can get away with it. I don't think many Afghans can, or they certainly don't feel they can.
Male or female?
The governor saying, look, sorry?
I said male or female?
Male or female. Certainly not female, but male or female. I mean, people were gawking, other people who had to conduct business at the bank. I approached the governor about this, and, I said, look, I think that this is actually a security issue because people are so upset about this bribe-taking that, you know, this is also what is causing them to maybe, you know, as I say, make room in their mosque for 20 Taliban or cook some dinner for them or something like that. And I said, I think if you tackle this problem, you know, you could make Kandahar a beacon for the rest of this country. And he came up with a whole list of reasons why it's not possible to take on the corruption. One being, you know, that you have to have watertight proof and nobody ever, you know, the people who give bribes are also benefiting from faster service and this and that. I mean, it was a lot of smoke screens. There is also the issue that public servants are underpaid. My answer to that is, well, then institutionalize the bribe taking. Put up a sign that says this, you know, we're going to add a surcharge of this many Afghanis for this, you know, administrative task and this many Afghanis for this administrative task, and make sure that money goes directly into people's salaries until they have a decent salary level, and then you can fire them the second you hear them, you know, doing any misconduct. But he came up with another issue that I actually did find a little bit cogent, which was, you know, if I remove someone from office, he then goes to Kabul, where, incidentally, public office is for sale, you know, and he can get an order reinstating himself. And then what do I do? And I had to admit that he had a point there. The problem is the corruption is systemic. And so you really need to, I think this is a place where internationals could bring some very useful pressure to bear and say that this is just no longer on.
I'm talking to Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent on today's Underreported. She now lives in Kandahar, where she has started a cooperative business called Arghand. She's also written a book that will be published by Penguin later this summer called The Punishment of Virtue Inside Afghanistan and After the Taliban. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sarah Chase live from Kandahar for our Underreported segment today. Sarah, yesterday, Condoleezza Rice told Hamid Karzai that the Taliban will be beaten. Is that claim likely, or is that just wishful thinking?
I don't really see any indications that they're being beaten. And part of the reason, I hate to sound like a broken record, but part of the reason is that it's not merely a military issue. Basically, it feels like there's a factory for these Taliban across the border from here that can basically churn out as much cannon fodder as is needed. The problem is the disappointment in the government, in the way the government is conducting itself, which means that ordinary Afghans have basically withdrawn themselves from the whole nation-building process. It's been very interesting to watch the developments down here as really heavy fighting has moved in toward Kandahar. The first thing, if you don't mind, I'd love to tell a couple of stories. One is the real major combat here started a couple of months ago, and it started when Taliban basically left their calling card at a village and said, look, if you have any trouble with the government or government soldiers, you should call us up because we're ready to fight. We've got 300 people between here and, you know, 10 miles from here, and we're spoiling for a fight. So suddenly you had a situation where the tables were turned, and instead of the government hunting the Taliban and the coalition hunting the Taliban, as we keep hearing they're doing, it was the Taliban hunting the government. And what happened was that's a poppy-growing area, and there was a person who was, this is the story I get from the villagers. I haven't been able to confirm it, but it's at least what they believe. And so it has some value in that regard. So the story I heard was that somebody was informing on the poppy growing to the government, which would come and basically break up the poppy fields, eradicate the plant. And after the villagers caught on to this, they decided they'd call this Taliban number. And they said, look, this is the situation we've got. And the Taliban said, well, you make another meeting with this guy, and we'll ambush him. So the Taliban caught the guy, told the guy to call in the police the way he usually does, and the Taliban then ambushed the police force. That that skirmish ended more or less inconclusively. And then, you know, later battles where there's been close air support from the American American-led coalition, there have been a lot of casualties on the Taliban side. That in turn, and also some casualties among civilians and a lot of people having to flee the area and stuff like that, which in turn has led to a kind of backlash on the part of ordinary locals who may have thought that giving Taliban a meal and a place to sleep was a relatively harmless protest vote, and then suddenly discovered, oh boy, you know, we have to leave our homes and our orchards and our trees are drying out, and golly, when there's a hot pursuit, some of us are getting killed. And so maybe it's not such a cheap protest vote after all. So you've had a number of village and district councils, which have been meeting in the last number of weeks. But very interestingly, they haven't turned around and sided with the government either. They've kind of set a plague on both your houses. They've almost treated the Afghan government and the Taliban as two schoolyard bullies and said, look, if you guys want to duke it out, you can duke it out. That's your problem. It's not our problem. Just don't do it on our land. You have to do it somewhere else. And in the case of one district, the district elders actually said, look, tell us, to the Taliban, they communicated with Taliban leaders and said, tell us what piece of our land you want. You know, do you want Zindawad Village? Do you want Talukan? We will empty it for you, and you can do your fighting from there. But don't leave that village. You know, don't leave that area. Don't go traipsing all around our district and drawing down coalition fire on us. And I found this to be a really, really interesting development. On the one hand, because it does show people kind of standing up through their indigenous democratic structures, district and village councils of elders, and taking their destiny in hand to some degree. What's very distressing about the development is that it indicates the degree to which Afghans who had treated this new regime with enormous high hopes in the beginning, back in 2002, the degree to which they're pretty much backing out of it and saying, you know, it's like an indictment of this almost five-year-old nation-building process.
We're talking with Sarah Chase live from Kandahar, Afghanistan, as part of our underreported series. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sarah, one interesting aspect of that story is that the Taliban came in to protect the poppy growers. Now, when they were in power, they actually cut down on the growth of poppy, which leads to opium. Right now, they are defending the growers at a time when cultivation has been decreasing.
They only cut back on poppy in the very last year of their reign in 2000. And it was a very cynical move. They had, in fact, been collecting religious tax called zakat on opium harvest. And the first 4 years or 5 years of their reign, or whatever you want to call it, the problem was that there was such a glut on the world opium market that the price had fallen. So they had plenty of stocks of opium paste, but they weren't getting as much money for it as they were before. So they thought, oh, we can kill two birds with one stone and get a little bit of international credit for banning poppy, while at the same time continuing to make plenty of money by selling reserves at a higher, basically international commodities value.
That's like with withholding. I was going to say that's like withholding petroleum,
right,
and saying that it isn't to drive up the price, but rather to protect the world against global warming.
That's exactly right. That's exactly a perfect analogy. So that's what happened. And now, you know, opium growing really has exploded, and these insurgents, or whatever they are cleverly exploiting, you know, the fact is that it's a mainstay of the economy. And the fact is that in spite of 5 years of alleged nation building and economic reconstruction, there really haven't been a lot of useful developments in terms of alternative livelihoods for people down here, particularly in a situation where there are no banks and therefore no credit, and no there's a drought, which means that most people are getting water out of the ground using diesel, which means, you know, they have to pay for their water at pretty high prices, and so they actually really need a cash crop. And so the Taliban are cleverly exploiting this situation by, as you point out, positioning themselves as the protectors of opium growers, meaning practically all the ordinary farmers around here. They've even been passing, you know, one of the things they do is paste up what are called night letters on mosques and walls of houses in villages. And while the government has been, you know, cajoling people to stop growing opium, the Taliban have been putting up night letters urging people to continue growing opium. So you definitely put your finger on an interesting dynamic.
Now, since this is called underreported, is the good news also underreported? Are more kids going to school? Are women at least a little freer than they were in the time that the Taliban controlled the country?
I would say, you know, there had been an upsurge in the first couple of years, but now I'm really, really experiencing greater caution. I'm experiencing people hoarding their savings together in case they have to move out of the country again. People, in fact, moving down from the countryside into Kandahar proper. People taking their girls out of school. The women who work with us are more and more concerned. They don't want, for example, we give them a lift home in the afternoon when they finish work, and they ask us to drop them off quite a few blocks away from their homes so that their neighbors don't see that they're working with anything resembling a nonprofit organization or an international organization or anything like that. I would say that things did go better, and then they've kind of regressed again.
Well, let's talk about your...
Audubon is going great. I have to say our own work is going really, really well. We have really, I mean, our production is excellent. We have a lot of interest from retail shops around the U.S. and Canada, in fact.
So how does that work? First of all, I was wondering whether the political troubles in Afghanistan are affecting your day-to-day operations, but it sounds to me like business is booming, one of the few positive stories we're hearing. You say that your soap is being sold around the United States. How is it marketed?
What we're doing is working with a group of interested, independent retailers, and we hope to sign one on in Manhattan in the next couple of weeks. I don't want to say the name because I'm not sure, you know, they haven't actually put in their order yet, but... partly because a lot of your listeners were really interested last time we talked about this. You know, we decided we really wanted to get something going in New York. We've got a couple in the Boston area, a couple in Canada, actually. The original Body Shop, which is now called Body Time, out in San Francisco. So it's really, you know, independent, mostly natural health and beauty type shops who are inspired by the project. I mean, it's not just soap. There's a whole story behind it, you know. And so it's been really, really inspiring for us also to develop this sort of community of shopkeepers and customers around the United States and, as I say, Canada.
And you have a website that people can go to if they're more interested in this?
We do indeed. It's www.arghand, and that's arghand.org. We can't yet fill retail orders because that just involves so much infrastructure. We're not quite there yet. But there is a list of retailers which is growing by the day. And in terms of our other activities, I mean, the situation has curtailed them somewhat. As I said earlier, we're working with local farmers to plant the indigenous variety of rose, which happens to be the one variety that produces rose oil. And this is something that, you know, which is a base for perfumes and which we use in our rose soap. And the cultivation of these roses had died out, partly because of the drought and the wars and all that kind of thing. And so we actually contracted with farmers and provided the input to get them to plant half an acre each of these roses. And for us, it was like the first stage of a kind of crop substitution program. We provided the inputs and guaranteed we'll buy the rose blossoms for 5 years. And I believe that it's only that kind of a problem, it's only that kind of a program that could really hope to begin to supplant opium cultivation in this region. Unfortunately, most of our plantations are in Pantwai District, the very district that has been the site of, the last couple of months fighting.
And Sarah, we will pick up on this. On this when you come back to New York. I understand you're coming back in September to talk about your book. And I'm assuming that you're going to come on the show to talk about it. The book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban, from Penguin. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.